Okay, this is the seventh principle, and one of my very favorite ones to speak about. I learned about this, made this one of the guiding principles, my top 10 secrets, if you will, for success and inner peace. When I was a leader of a group of people who were in alcohol rehabilitation and drug addiction rehab, and I walked into the room to be a part of this group, and there was a sign on the wall, and I noted it, and I had never really thought of it before, and it became this seventh principle. It says, there are no justified resentments. And I thought how frequently in my own lifetime I have justified my own resentments about the way I have been treated, about things that have happened to me, about the way I have viewed other people's behavior and putting the attention on myself and so on. And I got to talking about, in this group, what we were told when we were going through the training to lead these groups, which was many years ago in my doctoral studies, because my doctoral dissertation was about group counseling and group therapy. We were told that no matter what happens in this group, no matter what somebody says, no matter how offensive it may sound to you, no matter how angry it may make you that they are saying what they are saying, there are no justified resentments. And the reason that you cannot justify any of your resentments is because your resentments are serving to hurt you rather than to help you. And those resentments that you carry around, even though you think you have every right in the world to feel that way, I've heard people say it many times, I have a right to be miserable, married to the person that I'm married to. If you were married to this person, you would feel that you had a right to be miserable as well. And people go around defending their rights to be miserable, or defending their rights to be unhappy, or even defending their rights to be depressed. Depression is a big thing these days, and people believe that they have a right to their depression. After all, what I've been through and all that I have experienced, and they're willing to share that right away. And of course, and since I wrote about that and put it down as one of my most important principles, guiding principles of my life, I started thinking about my own resentments as well, and I had many that I was still justifying. And I'd like you to really take a look at this, and I present it from a little different perspective than any of the other of these 10 principles. See, I think of this game show that's on television called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And most of you have seen it. It's on all over the world. And in this game show, there are two levels that you want to reach. The first level is called the $1,000 level. And this $1,000 level is basically a giveaway level. It's a very simple level to get to. If you get to this $1,000 level, what you have is you have to answer 3 or 4 or 5 questions, I believe it is. And they're quite simple questions. And then you get to go away with something. So in listening to this program and attending this seminar here, if you go away, if you want to go away with at least something, I suggest that you get to this level before you leave here. And this $1,000 level is the level that is called ridding yourself of all blame. Now this means, and this is different for many people, it means taking total responsibility for everything that is going on in your life. Everything. So the condition of your marriage, the state of your health, whatever weight you have or don't have or wouldn't like to have, whatever illnesses are a part of your life, everything. You say, and you do it without guilt. So that if you have cancer, you don't say, I deserved cancer for something that I did. Because God isn't about distributing cancer to some people and not to others on the basis of whether they behave or follow a certain set of rules. What you say to yourself is, I have it, it's mine, I own it, and I only have a capacity to do something about it if I take responsibility for it. So you do it without guilt, without any assignment of you have been a bad person because of whatever is going on physically. And this is going on whether you have arthritis or bursitis or whether you have heart disease or whatever. I'm standing in front of you and talking to you, and I've talked over the years about how I don't even get colds. And yet, I had a heart attack. And I don't do heart attacks. I never thought it was possible for me to do heart attacks. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I meditate, I have a relatively stress-free life. I watch my diet, I keep my cholesterol low, I'm not overweight. I do all of the things that you're supposed to do. I don't even drink soda pop. I drink water all the time. I do everything that all the manuals tell me to do. And how could this possibly happen to me? I just don't understand this. You see? And now you know something? That little voice that I just gave really is sort of representative of what I experienced when that elephant came into that room in Tallahassee, Florida and sat on my chest that night in the middle of the night. I was in a total state of denial that this is something that could possibly happen to me. But everything that has ever happened to me in my life, or everything that I have created in my life, has always been a part of my teaching. It's been a part of my material, if you will, part of what I go out there and write about. And as soon as I had this heart attack and went through the experience, and came out of it, I rewrote the foreword to A Spiritual Solution to Every Problem, just to let people know that this is something that I had to deal with as well, that I'm not above any of this. And I had to learn two very important things firsthand after that heart attack. One was the essence and the importance of uncertainty as a part of the spiritual path. That in the physical world, there is no such thing as certainty. And uncertainty, the minute that you think you've got everything handled, the minute you think you've got everything straightened out. I mean, I talked to a man, Jeff, yesterday, who was married to, very happily married, to a woman who is a physician, pediatrician, bright lady, and she had a fall just out of nowhere, fell with her mom, was it, Jeff? And she was okay afterwards. She seemed to be okay. Didn't go to the hospital. That night she died. Gone. In one moment. And he's here and working on it. And a beautiful man. It was great talking with you yesterday. But I haven't been able to get that out of my mind because I was doing the same thing in that hospital when I was lying there. And I was having different doctors come in, and it was very interesting. The doctors that would come in that were pessimistic, who told me, well, you know, this could be a quintuple bypass. I said, what the hell? Quintuple? What are five things, you know? And we could take veins out of your ears and your butt and your legs and put them in there. We might have to go and get cow's veins or something. I mean, and I couldn't wait for them to get out of the room. They were just telling me all of the things that could possibly go wrong. And then the other doctor, my cardiologist, Dr. Bartokas, would come in and he said, I've seen you running. I know your life. I've read your book. He said, you've probably got one blockage in one artery. It's probably some genetic thing. We'll pop it out. We'll stick in a stent there. And he said, you'll be out of there the next day. And he would walk out of the room. I'd say, excuse me, why don't you come back? I'd like you to spend a little more time here with me. And it was energy. It was always energy. And the ones that would come in with the negativity, I wanted to sort of dismiss. But the ones who came in with... So I learned to deal with uncertainty. And I watched people. The man that was next to me in the room there in the cardiac ward, didn't make it through the night. And I watched him come. That was the other thing I had to deal with, not just on an intellectual level, what you've had to deal with, Jeff, on a physical level, is that our own mortality. Maslow said that self-actualizing people get over death almost as if it didn't happen, because for them it doesn't. Because none of us are born and none of us are dead. Those are all illusions. That's just because we identify ourselves with our bodies. And when you begin to see yourself as a spiritual being, and you truly begin to see it, and you can't see it until you have that experience. And when you have that experience, your own mortality is something you become the observer of. And as you said to me yesterday, Jeff, I'm just grateful for the time that I had together with her. And that's the way you look at it, knowing that in a world of eternity, death is impossible. So I had those two very important and powerful lessons to learn: uncertainty, mortality, and the physical sense. And I take total responsibility for it. And what turns out is that I did have a blockage in one artery, not a real serious one. They call it the widow maker. As he explained it to me, I said, oh, that's a real nice name for it. The LAD, if you know what the LAD is, the lower anterior descending, and there was a little kink in it, and cholesterol had accumulated in there, and I had this blockage. And he also told me that I wouldn't have survived it had I not been an athlete and running and keeping myself in shape over the past 30 years or so. He said, you have the heart of a very strong young man. You just have a blockage in the widowmaker. And they put a stent in there, and the next day I walked 5 miles. The next day. And I was running 2 weeks later, and having stress tests a lot more these days. And checking on things like cholesterol and so on. But it raised my consciousness level. It also taught me to be a bit more compassionate than perhaps I had been in the past with people who suffer from these kinds of struggles in their lives. But it was important for me to take responsibility for it. You see, if you don't take responsibility for what is going on in your life, in your body, in your relationships, everywhere, if you don't take responsibility for it, you are placing responsibility on something or someone outside of yourself. And in order for you to be able to do something about it, you have to wait for something or someone or some event outside of yourself to change in order for you to get better. And the likelihood of that happening is very small. But if it's on you, and it is yours, and you own it, then at least you have the potential or the capacity or the ability to be able to create the willingness to say, I think I'm going to work at doing something about this. I'm going to haul in a miracle. I'm going to call in one. Or I'm going off to the wilderness, as that woman I told you about earlier did. I'm going off to the wilderness, and I'm going to make contact with God, and I'm going to get quiet and peaceful for the first time in my life. I'm going to use the nature, the wilderness, as therapy. I'm going to trust my instincts. I'm going to turn it over to God. I can do anything. But if it's somebody else's fault, or the fact that we live in a carcinogenic world, or the fact that something out there happened when I was a little boy or a little girl, I can't change the facts. I can't change the facts. But I can change how I deal with them. So blame has to go. Now, in order to rid yourself of blame, you have to practice something called forgiveness. You can't get past the $1,000 level where you can leave this program with at least something unless you're willing to forgive. And A Course in Miracles has one of the most profound lines I've ever come across. It says, in order to forgive, you must have blamed. If you never blamed, you don't have anything to forgive. You don't have anyone to forgive. So getting rid of blame and forgiveness are synonymous terms. They're the same thing. And forgiveness as Mark Twain said, forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it. Forgiveness is the lesson of visionary consciousness. It's the image of Jesus on a cross and being further tortured, and out of him comes, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And what is meant by that in my heart is they don't understand that when they throw a spear into me, they're throwing a spear into all of humanity. Because Jesus was not one who spoke of the flesh. He spoke of the oneness, the connectedness of all of us, excluded no one. And always remember that as you practice being Christ-like. There is no one to exclude, no one. Not in the kingdom of heaven. So forgiveness means taking a look at your past, recapitulating, as I spoke about earlier, if you will, and deciding that you have no enemies. Just the absence of the possibility of any enemies being in your life. And everyone, and you might want to make a list of, or you might want to go through all of the people who have harmed you in any way. The parents who behaved in the ways that they did, the children who don't respect you, the spouse who walked out on you, the person who borrowed money from you and has never paid it back, the person who sued you and you had put you through all of those kinds, all of that, whatever you do. And I've told the story before of a time in my life when I had a lawsuit imposed upon me for the only time in my life, by a woman who had spent 15 years in a mental institution and who decided that what I had written about and spoken about on the radio was the cause of her mental illness. And she got an attorney to take that case. And it was thrown out in what they call a summary judgment, and they appealed the summary judgment. So they continued to keep this wound festering. And I spent a couple of years being concerned about my reputation. It was before I really stopped caring about things like that. This goes back 20 or so years. Now, if somebody wants to say that I was the cause of the mental illness, I'll say, well, I'm listening to that. Yeah. That's an interesting point of view. I never thought of that before. Maybe I did. And also, when you turn 60, you stop caring what other people think anyway, I think. But at any rate, I carried that around, and I hired an attorney, and I spent a lot of money, and I was angry at this particular person for doing all of this and so on. And then I remember in a meditation just saying, I'm through with all of this. I called my attorney. I said, I'm not paying any more money for this. I'm not giving it any more energy whatsoever. None. I refuse to participate in it. I'll just ignore it. And they can make all the threats they want. They can say anything they want. It's an absurdity, and I won't play the game anymore. And I then started in my meditations to surround this particular person with love, just as much light and love as I could possibly get to this person. And I did it in the morning. I did it in the afternoon. I did it in the evening. And I tried to imagine with some compassion that I didn't have before what it must be like to live in a mental institution for 15 years. And how terrible and awful that was. Instead of thinking about me and what was happening to me, I began to put love toward this person. And I had flowers sent to her. And I sent some books. And on the third day after I started practicing this, the lawsuit was dropped. So it was again one of those lessons. Everything I think that I go through in my life is always a lesson. And almost every struggle that I've ever gone through has taught me to be a little less blaming, a little more forgiving, a little more compassionate, a little kinder, always. It seems to work that way. So now when those crappy things start showing up in my life, I just stop telling myself that this shouldn't be happening, and I go into that place where I say, what's the lesson here? What do I have to learn? And I can help it to go away and attract into my life something different. Forgiveness is the essence of higher consciousness and spirituality. If you want to understand, there are no justified resentments. That's the $1,000 level. No blame, total responsibility, no guilt, no I deserve this, just no blame. I'll take it all on. It's all mine. I own every bit of it. And remember, everything that you consider to be a problem in your life is really just an illusion. If I could just take you in this moment and put you into a coma for a day or so, in that day, when you couldn't think, all of your problems would disappear. If you open up the Torah, open up the Old Testament, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. 31 lines later, it says, and all that God created was good. That presents an enormous conundrum for those of us who believe in problems. If God created everything, and everything that God created was good, then problems, evil, disease, disorder, disharmony, all of these things represent our moving away from God and taking on this ego consciousness. And all we have to do is begin to move back towards God, which is what every one of these principles in some way or another has something to do with. Stopping this absurd notion that you are separate from God, you are what you have and what you do, and what others think of you, and all of this, and rerouting yourself so that you're moving back towards God rather than away from God. So that's the $1,000 level. Now you answer 5 more questions. And metaphorically, these are more difficult questions. But if you do that, you get to the $32,000 level. And the $32,000 level is the level that gives you 2 things. First of all, you get to leave this program, you get to leave here, with something very substantial. $32,000. Metaphorically, I'm speaking about leaving here with something, a very substantive amount, $32,000. Metaphorically, it means you get something really worthwhile. All right? But you got to go through these 5 questions. And when you get to this level of $32,000, not only do you get to leave with something very substantial, but you also open up the vista, you open up the windows, if you will, to look out onto the potential for enormous, enormous wealth, not just substantial wealth. You get to look at $1 million level. You're just looking at it. It isn't a guarantee, but if you don't get past this level, you don't ever even get to look at it. And this is the $32,000 level in this principle that there are no justified resentments. In response to everything, you must be able to give away love. The ability to give love, no matter what comes your way, is the $32,000 level. It's that notion that Patanjali spoke about. When you find it in your heart, when you become steadfast in your abstention of thoughts of harm directed toward others, all living creatures will cease to feel enmity in your presence. This is spiritual consciousness. This is the place where resentments become impossible. So that you get the opportunity to practice this on a regular basis with virtually anyone that comes into your life. No matter what they say, and the worst that they say gives you an opportunity to practice it. The more hostile they are, the greater your opportunity to practice this. Because anybody can send love in response to a person who smells good, or a person who looks good, or a very nice person. Anybody can send love there. It's easy to raise a child who always behaves and always says, yes, mom, and yes, daddy, yes, I love you, and does everything that they're supposed to. I've never seen any of those children. No, I have. That's not true. I have. Some of my children were much easier to raise and to love than others. All of my children were easy to love, but some of them, it was more difficult to express it than others. And when a person behaves in a way towards you that you find offensive or that you find difficult or who violates a principle that you believe in or who refuses to acknowledge you or to be nice and so on, and your response is to lower the energy field by being the way they are, you are not at the $32,000 level. It's the thing that St. Francis taught us with his life. It's what Gandhi taught us with his life. When Gandhi was assassinated in 1948, out of him came the words Ram, Ram, Ram. And he died. God. 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 Because that's all he had inside. His life was his message. And when we create that kind of an awareness within ourselves, in response to the things that are most difficult, and I must say that this seems to be easier for women to do and mothers to do than men, because the wars are not fought by women on our planet, by and large. There's a feminine energy, a feminine consciousness that I've watched mothers. I've watched my wife. I've watched my own mother. I've watched other mothers. I've been a counselor and a therapist to many mothers. I've watched them when their children are abusive and say nasty things, and a man will often interpret their sending love in response to that as a weakness. But somehow instinctively they know that this is the way that I'm supposed to be. It's instinctive. It's cellular. They can't help themselves. These are their children or other people's children. These are the people that I love. And you'll see them tolerate it. And the man, including myself, for a good part of my life, it's like, you know, they just need a good kick in the ass. Or they really need to be slapped around a little. Or they need to be told, you know, and it's like, and you respond with anger to that. But there's an instinctive notion of being able to send love. That's what St. Francis taught us with his life. That's why I dedicated Spiritual Solution to him. That's why I wrote half the book based upon that famous prayer attributed to St. Francis. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. If we want to truly call ourselves spiritual beings, if we truly want to believe in the messages of the most influential who have ever walked among us, the Muhammads, the Buddhas, the Jesus, the Lao Tzu's, these people came here and taught us a message. And that message is in response to everything. Be steadfast in your abstention of thoughts of harm. And you can change people around you by bringing that energy instead of joining them in the lower energy that they have. You can change that. It's astonishing. I've watched myself practice this. A mother, not too long ago, was yelling at a child, 2-year-old child, in a grocery store, screaming and hollering. And I just moved in a little closer and attempted to just, instead of giving a lecture and saying, excuse me, but, you know, I've written a book about a spiritual solution, Debbie. I'd like to have a talk with you right here. Instead of that approach, what I did was I just moved into there and tried to radiate out a different energy, just sending out a higher and a faster energy. And as I did that, I noticed that the mother not only stopped, but the child began to feel a little bit more comfortable as well. That you can, when you practice it, and I know what you're thinking, and I know I can hear the resistance to this, how difficult it is. They say that the most difficult thing, the most difficult thing in the world to do is to send love in response to hate. The second is to defend the absent. Defend the absent. Whoever is there being talked about, somebody has to take their position. You be that person. And the third is to admit that you were wrong. Not in that you made a mistake, but that you have been making the wrong kinds of choices in your life and have led to this right now. But the most difficult, according to Anthony DeMello, is to send love in response to hate. And when you can become steadfast in your abstention of thoughts of harm directed toward others, everything and everyone around you will be impacted. But more than anything else, what it does is it gives you the opportunity to have the awareness that every resentment you have is a lower energy. You want to stop justifying it and instead get rid of the blame at the $1,000 level, and at the $32,000 level, send love to it. Send kindness to it. Send peace to it. Even if it just takes a moment of contemplative prayer. What I'd like to do now is, again, have you take everything off of your laps, if you will, and just put both feet on the ground. And I'd like to close out this session with a song that I often use. It's a song that, if you ever want to know how to raise your energy level, some people have been asking about this CD, Cecilia. This CD is like spiritual solution to every problem for me. I told you there's energy in the photograph of that book on that cover. I know that there's energy because I know what had just transpired. There's also energy in this. And I have this in my car, and I set it at number 6. And I play this song virtually every day, particularly if I'm in traffic and I want to see if I can make the traffic move. I'm serious. Because I remember I said, have no limitations on what you think you can possibly do and create. Have no limitations on that at all. You can make traffic move. And especially if I feel myself upset about something, or if I'm not feeling quite well, or if my partner caused us to lose another tennis match, or whatever, I put on this song. It was a song, I've been calling it higher energy, I've been calling it faster energy. I encourage you to have this, because I believe one of the ways that we can raise our levels of consciousness and raise our energy, one of the ways to do that is through music. And in The Eye of the Eye, Hawkins speaks about different kinds of music and different songs as having calibrating at different levels. And some music calibrates very low and weakens us, particularly rap and gangster rap kind of music and things like that. It literally weakens everyone who's in the energy field of it. And you know that because there's certain kinds of things that are not only strident to you, but you can feel yourself feeling less peaceful and feeling more anxious when you're in the presence of it. This song was written in the 18th century by John Newton. It's a song that my daughter sings at the end of every PBS special. It's called Amazing Grace. And he was a slave trader, 22 years old, crossing from Senegal in West Africa to go into South Carolina. And in the midst of a storm, he heard these words come to him. I once was lost, he said, and now I'm found. And it was grace. And he called this moment of Satori, his moment of finding God. And when the storm was over, the next day, he turned his ship around. And he went back to Africa. And he unloaded all of the people who he had intended to sell into slavery, and went back to England and became the most ardent abolitionist on the planet for the next 55 years until he was 77 years old, John Newton. Worked to abolish slavery in one moment, in one instant of Satori. And it's sung by Cecilia, who has one of the most beautiful voices I've ever heard. And she's accompanied by the Wails on this, particularly throughout the whole CD. This CD is a consciousness raiser, and that's why I have it available at all of my talks. And here she is, Cecilia. She's from Norway, the land of the midnight sun. And she sings Amazing Grace, accompanied by the Wails, who are said to be the record keepers in the spiritual community, because they're in the same bodies they were in a million years ago. I love that line. I once was lost, and now I'm found. And I interpret that always to mean I once lived in those lower energies of resentment and justified them. And now I bring the energy of grace to the presence of everything. And that song always just seems to bring me up. That's why I asked my daughter to sing it. And that's why I wanted to play it for you here today. Any thoughts? Any? Yeah.
Yesterday, we talked, and I mentioned that I also grew up with an alcoholic stepfather who, you know, always told me to never amount to anything or anything, never be anything. And recently I sold my business and ordered a new car with the intentions of driving out to his grave and urinating on it. Now, you're telling me I'm going to have to go out there and pray for him. Am I correct? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I think that, first of all, you know, urine is part of the natural juices. So it's not, it's only bad because we just interpret it to be bad. Some people use it to heal, you know, in other parts of the world. And some people even drink it, you know, as a healing. But I think that the relevance of that question, and I think it's a good one, is because I wanted to do that too, is that our greatest teachers are not the people who agree with us. And many times the most powerful and important teachers in our life, in fact, you might only be where you are today and have that car because this teacher came along. Who's to know? Now think about this. Who's to know in an infinite universe in which there's no beginning and no end, how many lifetimes we get? If it's infinity, you get as many as it's, you know, there's no number that you can place on it. And who's to know that, I mean, one little lifetime, that this father of yours, stepfather of yours, like my father, just signed up and said, you know, I remember Betty Eady writing about this in one of her books, saying that somebody had incarnated onto this plane in order to sit as a bum in front of a particular office entrance in order to have someone walk by and see them and develop some compassion that they didn't have before. And he said, I'll take a lifetime to do that. And who's to know that this stepfather didn't incarnate into this world to talk to you about what a jerk you were and to put all of these kinds of negative thoughts into your mind in order to teach you how to transcend your own, you know, your own anger and your own hatreds and your own lower consciousness, your own levels. And that perhaps, you know, I've often said that the people who can push your buttons and the people who can send you into those lower places are your greatest teachers that you'll ever have. Because they teach you that you haven't mastered yourself yet. And when you haven't mastered yourself, what that means is you still don't know how to choose peace in response to their hostility and in response to what they have done. And they keep pushing you. They keep pushing you. And they never go away. They never disappear. I call them, they're like turds that won't flush. You know, they just keep coming back and coming back and coming back. He may have been the person that is most responsible, like my own father might have been the person most responsible because I wanted to prove something and I needed to forgive. And maybe he showed up just to teach me to forgive. And when I did, everything in my life turned around. Everything. So I'd send him some flowers on his grave. Yeah.
Does forgiveness mean you have to accept someone back into your life, or can you accept forgive someone at a distance?
It has nothing to do with whether they're there present physically or not. Nothing to do with that at all. Forgiveness is an act of the heart. What you're talking about is an act of the feet. You know, whether they're going to be there or not going to be there. Forgiveness is an act of the heart. It takes place in here. And many times, the people that you have to forgive, it's like everybody in your life is like a character in a play. Okay? So the character in the play, some of them are in for the first act. And some of them are in for the first two acts. Some are in for the whole play. All right? And some just make entrances and then they leave. And some have roles to play that are not quite as salubrious as you would like them to be. But they're all just characters in this play called your life. And it doesn't mean that if someone, let's say you were married to someone that was very abusive and hostile to it, you got to be able to still send them love. That's what it's all about. But you don't have to stay with them. You don't ever have to be a victim. They have played out. They were in the first act or the first two acts, but they're not in the third act or the fourth act. They're not there any longer. It's just a play. All the world is a play, is a stage, and we're just actors on that stage. Yeah, any others? Yes.
We had a mother and her two daughters struck by a motorist whose car went out of control in front of our school building about a week and a half ago. And the thing that I was impressed with was the father who I spoke with was praying for that motorist as well as for his wife and the three children. And at the celebration of the life, we sung Amazing Grace. So I'm very touched.
You just saw the hockey. Did you see the hockey trial? And the man who got manslaughter and for beating up this other man, the man's father, who lost his son to the brutality of this particular man, put his arm around the man and said, "I forgive you, I forgive you." There's never any peace unless you do, because if you have that hatred and you carry it around with you for the rest of your life, you can't justify a resentment. It's like a snake bite. The bite doesn't kill you, and you can't be unbitten. It's the venom that continues to pour after the bite that is deadly. You have a choice about the venom that continues to pour after you've been bitten. You can't be unbitten, but you certainly don't have to have the venom.
Again, I understand forgiveness, but you say forgiveness has to come from the heart, and I agree with that. But if you feel so hurt over something, how do you get that forgiveness how do you feel it in your heart? I can say it, I can articulate it, but I don't always have that feeling that I'm really doing it.
Our feelings come from our thoughts, and you just think it enough until the feeling energy begins to materialize for you. You think it enough. You just keep thinking it, and eventually you will feel what you are thinking. That's why I tell people who are trying to do anything that is difficult, just keep saying it over and over again.
I'd like to share something to you and some other folks that have said something or asked questions. I'm in recovery from addiction, and we know that we aren't allowed the luxury of justified resentments because they kill. And early on, I was taught to get rid of them, to pray for the people I had resentments towards. And that's the absolute last thing that I wanted to do. And the people who suggested this to me told me, you don't have to really mean it. That just get on your knees and pray for these people to have everything that you want for yourself. And I am here to tell everybody in this room that the act of doing that releases the anger, releases the resentment, and the emotions would turn to neutral and then even to love. And when you ask, do you really have to mean it? For me, I did not have to mean it. But by doing it, I eventually did mean it.
It's a very good point. It can be summarized with fake it until you make it. We're going to do the last three principles today, but I want to have a ceremony here this morning. Anyway, there's a gentleman that's been here with us who his name is John. He's standing right next to me. Many of you, I'm sure, have met. Who has a severe disability and was told certain things that he would never be able to do. And it really fits in with this very first principle today. So this eighth principle is called treat yourself as if you already are what you would like to become. One of the most important things I think you can learn in life, and particularly for young people just starting out in life. But it's important for all of us. And I think that's something that John has done. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to John. He's going to do a little performance here for us for the first 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll get started.
Good morning. It's a thrill to be here. This is a 24-year process for me to be here in this room with you. When I was 4, I was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, which, if you don't know, is a chronic pulmonary disease. To this day, it's the number one genetic killer of young children in this country. About 30,000 Americans have it. And at that time, when I was 4, unbeknownst to me, the doctor said, well, he's going to live to about 12. So if you would just go out and just love him and embrace him and just push him, we'll see how far he can go. And so mom and dad, with that instruction, put me on a soccer field thinking running was a really good thing, and put me in a swimming pool because swimming was a really good thing. And I had this idea that I wanted to play drums, and the doctor said, well, why don't we try trumpet and see if that happens. And so I started playing trumpet in about third grade, and this disease that was supposed to take my life for some reason stayed dormant. And it was a true gift that out of the 700 genotypes of cystic fibrosis that there are, and I have the worst of that, that the pulmonary restriction stayed absolutely dormant. And so I ran, and I swam, and I played, and I sang, and I was fortunate enough to excel in most of those things. And life seemed pretty good. And at 12 years old, mom and dad thought, well, let's just keep pushing him. And so just competition after competition after competition. And finally, I got to 19. And looking back, what mom and dad were really doing was raising a no-limit child, that there were no restrictions, that there were no limits of what someone could accomplish, regardless of what medical technology said was going to happen. And so at 19, I took it upon myself to become a no-limit partier rather than a no-limit person. And freshman year of college, I decided that I would try just about anything and everything that was out there. And suddenly, what was once dormant became dominant. And this disease just rose up and bit me. And at that point, I went from the ability to run 5 miles a day, swim 2 miles a day, bike 10 miles a day, to not being able to walk 30 feet to that door without passing out. Cystic fibrosis is a disease that fills your lung up with that same dark green phlegm crap that you have when you have pneumonia or bronchitis. And in there is a bacteria that eats away at your lung linings, so that slowly, from the day you're born, in most cases, that phlegm builds up and destroys your small airways and destroys your medium airways and then eventually destroys your large airways to where you suffocate. So at 19, my life changed drastically. I was a first trumpet player at a well-known university as a freshman. The world was in front of me. My goal was to be on the Tonight Show Band with Doc Severinsen and Johnny Carson. And suddenly that wasn't available to me. And I went into the hospital and changed schools and got out, and 3 weeks later was back in the hospital, and got out, and a month later was back in the hospital. And the doctors came to me at that time and said the progression of this disease happened so rapidly that a life expectancy of about 3 years is what I would expect. And I said, but what about trumpet playing? You know, and they said, well, if you're going to die in 3 years, what's the sense of continuing to practice? And that was how harsh it was. It was an expectation that that was where I was going to go. And that third hospitalization, I was sitting there and had a pretty prayerful life and was praying for an answer, some sort of guidance that would wake me up, that would give me some sort of roadmap how to work my way out of this. Because after all, I hadn't died when I was 12. Why should I really die when I was 19? And so I was sitting there, and I'd watched Johnny Carson every night since I was 9 or 10, waiting for that ultimate moment with Doc when get a solo, which he never did get a solo. Carson would always say, we're going to have Doc, and I'd stay till 1:30, and we never had Doc. And then one night, as I was there in the hospital, this man walked out with this book called Uroniosomes. And within a week, I had that book. And Pull Your Own Strings and Sky's the Limit. And then came those first set of tapes from Cleveland, right? Well, I took those tapes and I did dupe them and had them in the car and had them in my Walkman. And absolutely owned the knowledge that my thought was the miracle that came was that I was watching Johnny Carson that night. And I can recite to you every humorous point in there and every serious point, whether it's the parachutist that forgot he had a cold until he got back in the car, or the ant with a bad merge genes, and the adult student that you made collect butterflies. And I took that knowledge and I said, you know, if this is possible to think in terms of no limits, then why should I limit myself by what the medical doctors say? After all, I'm as wise as they are. I'm as intelligent as they are. They're just older with a little bit more money and a degree. And so if that's their opinion, I'm going to draw a line in the sand and I intend to beat this disease. So with that, I went off on my own and made mistake after mistake until I found a path of waking up every day knowing that I was winning. And over the years, everybody would walk into me and say, but how is it you do that? What's your strength? How is it that you got from facing death to living life at this level of enjoyment? And for years, I would say, Wayne Dyer saved my life. And it wasn't probably until 5 years ago, 19, 29, 17, 18 years ago, where suddenly it dawned on me that Wayne hadn't saved my life. What he had done is given me tools to choose life over death. And the gift isn't that I'm still here. The gift is that in choosing life over death, that I've been able to be of service to a multiple of people in hospitals that I would never have had the opportunity to meet before. 10-year-old roommates, parents of newly diagnosed children with CF, staff members with family critical problems that come into the room and through my presence or my joy walk away different. And the gift of service is truly the gift that you brought to me. This summer I was with one of the largest entertainers in the world who was facing his health problems, and he was in the hospital and he came into the room and we sat there knee to knee for an hour. And at 75 years old, he wanted to know at that point in his life how I did this. Do you want to give up? Ever? No. Do you get up every day and do this? Yes. 4 or 5 hours of treatments every day. 100 years of hospitalizations every year. Where does that come from? And a man that had been an inspiration for my entire life in the entertainment business suddenly heard he needed to go pick up some Wayne Dyer books because he was facing his own challenges at that point in his life. These last 6 months, since September 11th, I've had some personal issues that just rocked my inner peace and rocked my spiritual world to the depth of areas that I haven't been till I was 19. This Christmas was the first time I was hospitalized. No family, no friends. I'd lost a best friend with CF in October. I'd lost a 14-year relationship in November. And here I was in a hospital facing for the first time what it was like to worship on Christmas alone. But during that holiday season, when I was struggling for this inner peace and struggling for this spiritual guidance, I turn on the television and who do I see but doing a PBS special? Wayne Dyer. And as you said yesterday, the teacher is always available when you're ready to learn. So I would just like to share with you that whatever adversity that's challenging you today, own it. Embrace it. Be spiritual about it. Because you never know the next day how you face that adversity is going to impact somebody else. And in return, impact somebody else. And that's the gift. The struggle day to day is not a problem. It's the gift that makes the struggle worthwhile. So thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Dan. So you picked the one instrument that you need lung power for to play. Dan's going to play the trumpet for us when he recollects himself, you know, after this session. That was great. I never like to take the credit for anybody's movement along the path, because if you take the credit, you got to take the blame. I've often said that you see a lot of bumper stickers around the country that say, if you can read this sign, thank a teacher. But I've never seen one that says, if you can't read this, blame a teacher. So you're right. I think of what I do and the work I've done and the books I've produced and the tapes and so on as very much like the manual in your car. You know, when you get a flat tire, which I just did recently, in a rent a car on Maui, out in the middle of nowhere after being on horses all day. You reach into the glove compartment and there's a little manual, and if you wait for it to fix the flat, you're going to sit there for a long time. But if you open it up and take what's in there and apply it, you put on that little donut and
get yourself a new car the next day. And a bill from them as well, by the way. So thanks, John, and I appreciate your words. You're very eloquent. You mesmerize this audience, and they will be words that will inspire people, not just for the next few years, but hundreds of years from now, when our children's 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 children are coming along. These words will be, and your words will be available to them. That's always the beauty of putting things out there, is that you create a permanent record for humanity. And you just never know. There might be some unborn soul who will decide that cystic fibrosis isn't something that they have to die from 1,000 years from now. Thanks. Okay, this this principle that I would like to speak about now is called treating yourself as if you already were what you'd like to become. And it's one of the things that we had when we were very young and oftentimes lose. Children are very good at this, at acting as if, just acting as if. My children are masters of this. They see themselves in their own minds as having what it is that they would like to attract into their lives. And they are able to get a picture of that. And in the process of getting that picture, they begin to act as if that picture were absolutely their reality. Now, one of the essays that I wrote in Wisdom of the Ages was based upon an observation of one of the most learned and brilliant teachers that ever came into my life. He was born in 1842. He died in 1910. His name was William James. And he was he came from a very famous family. Henry James, his younger brother, was one of the most famous novelists of all time in America. Many consider William James to be the father of modern psychology, the person who really began the whole idea of that the mind has some much more control over our bodies and our physical world than we ever thought of. And he had this to say, this is a direct quote of his. He said, there is a law in psychology, a law, that if you form a picture in your mind of what you would like to be, and you keep and hold that picture there long enough, you will soon become exactly as you have been thinking. He didn't say it was a high probability. He didn't say that it was likely or that it might happen. He said, if you can figure out a way to form a picture in your head of what it is that you would like to become, it has to materialize. I remember as a young boy speaking about The Tonight Show, watching Steve Allen night after night or night. We had a little Admiral television, a little black and white, about a 12-inch screen. And I would sit there and watch Steve Allen night after night after night. And while I was watching, I would picture myself as one of the guests on the show. And I would ask, I would get up the next night, I'd talk to my brothers and I'd talk to my mom, and I'd say, you know, when I do The Tonight Show, and they ask a question like that, I'm not going to answer it the way they did. I'm going to make it really come alive. And when I meet Steve Allen, and they would always say, oh God, that's Wayne. He's always such a dreamer. You're not doing The Tonight Show. You're just a little dork, as my brother would say. And, you know, just get used to it. And it wasn't like I would argue with them, or I would have fights with them, or I would try to persuade them of something to the contrary. It wasn't like that at all. I just always had the picture. I would have the same picture when I was in high school. And I'd sit there. I remember having a history teacher I'm debating, I won't give his name, but I remember it very well. I was in room 309, and it started at 2:05 in the afternoon, so you can look it up. And this man was so beaten down by the years and years of teaching history in a high school in Detroit. And I used to go into that class and I'd sit there and I'd think, when I do this, when I'm in front of a classroom, I will never, ever bore a group of people the way this man is doing. I just won't do it. And I used to think, he's got an entire audience. They're captive. They can't even leave if they want to. And he could be so funny and he could be so interesting. He could make this come alive. There's so many ways he could make American history, or with world history, you know, just come, become exciting and so on. And instead he just sits there and he's just beaten down. But I used to feel sorry for him. I did it in college in a thousand, or more, dull lectures of professors who were just, coming in there and just sort of going through the motions. And I used to think, boy, when I'm doing this, when I'm in front of college audiences and when I'm teaching, I'm just going to make sure that, when I, get that classroom that, they're going to want to come to my class. And sure enough, when I taught in high school, it was fun. My kids loved coming to class. And when I taught at the university, when I taught at St. John's University, the biggest problem I had with the dean at the university was that she called me down into her office and said, you're going to have to stop having people come as guests into your classes on Tuesday and Thursday nights because they're taking up all of the parking places at the university. Because I had a class of 30 or 40 students. And there were times when 200 people would show up. And I was taping those lectures to create a book called Your Erroneous Sounds. And I wrote it from those lectures that I had accumulated, and I taped everything. And I did most of it just from my heart. But I would use a form of entertainment and having people have fun and making it come alive and making it exciting and so on. And then after years of... after Erroneous Zones was published, and I was told by so many people about all the reasons why it was just another book on the list, and that there wouldn't be a second printing, that if we sell these out, there were 7,500, I think, books in the first printing, and if we sell those, that would be considered a successful publishing experience. And I had a different picture in my mind. And it had nothing to do with what I was being told by all of the publishers and people in New York. It had to do with that inner burning desire that I spoke about earlier. But it was a picture. And I saw myself as already doing what it is that I wasn't doing yet. And that's where I was. And so I consequently, when I couldn't get the kind of action that I wanted from them in terms of distribution, and I couldn't get them to even think about a second printing, I just became a bookstore. And I filed with the state authorities in New York and became a commercial establishment. And from that commercial establishment, I made a telephone call and ordered up the entire first printing that was left and had them shipped to my garage. And they ordered 2,500 more copies, and when I called up 2 or 3 weeks later and said, how's the book doing? And they said, oh, for gosh sakes, you know, you're always asking questions. I was just a big pain in the ass to everybody there. And I had already ordered the second printing to be sent to my garage as well. And the publisher looked at it and said, boy, this book is really selling. It's really doing well. Meantime, I had almost 10,000 books that I had to do something with. And I took those books literally. I took those books out and across the country, and I spoke all over the country and went to every small station and wherever anybody would take me. And it just kept doing it and doing it, going from one to the other. And I left one day. I was driving along the Long Island Expressway on my way from my home in Huntington to the university, and I realized that I couldn't do what I was doing any longer. Even though I had a guaranteed position for the rest of my life, I had a different picture in my head. And I didn't have the same internal enthusiasm for what I was doing any longer. I walked into the dean's office and I resigned. And she just told me that this was the most insane thing she'd ever heard. You're a rising star. You've published a couple of textbooks. Now you've got a book that's out there. We want to keep you here. And I said, no. I said, I've got to go. She said, well, what are you going to do? She said, jobs are very hard to come by. And college professor jobs at that time were very, very difficult to come by. And I said, I'm going to go out and talk about and do the things that I know I have to do. And I went out, and all of the worries and all of the fears, I just let them go because I knew it was time. And got in my car, took my family with me when I could, drove up and down the coast, did all-night radio shows many times. I did 14, 15 interviews in a day, and drove and found a way to get there myself, found like-minded people who supported me. People in the publishing world. I had a publicist. Her name was Donna Gould. And Donna just devoted herself to me for about 6 or 7 months, worked without any pay, called from her own phone at night, booked me into all of these different... she must have called the Phil Donahue show 50 times talking about it. And they always said, no, 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 if you call ever call here again and we hear the name Wayne Dyer, we'll never let you call us again or have any business to do with us. And finally, something very strange happened. Someone who became a friend named Howard Papish picked up a copy of your Erroneous Zones at a party out in New York. And on the way back to Los Angeles, he was a talent coordinator for The Tonight Show. He called after he read it and asked if I'd like to come out and do a pre-interview. And I went out and I did a pre-interview, and I was on the Tonight Show that Monday night with, it was the last Monday in August of 1976. And I was on with a man named Shecky Green, who was a comedian, a Las Vegas comedian. And I went on the show and had 20 minutes in what was called the author spot, when the show was 90 minutes at that time. And it was a wonderful experience. And then I went back to the airport at LAX, and I got a telephone call. They paged me and said that Bob Dole at the Republican National Convention in Kansas City, Missouri, had gone over in his address to the convention. And NBC had decided to cover it so that my show, for the first time in the Tonight Show history, had been preempted. And they weren't going to air it. And it was this big disappointment.